All right, we're back in the Beit Midrash after a little bit of a break. Good to see everybody. We're continuing in Masechet Yoma, the Masechta, the tractate about Yom Kippur, because like so many other things in Jewish tradition, Yom Kippur lasts all year. Not exactly the same way as Yom Kippur manifests on the day of Yom Kippur itself, but we're looking at it as something that lives, can live all year and inform us and inspire us and has what to learn in terms of the way it's presented in the Gemara. I want to remind you about the sources we looked at on the first day of the first semester, and that is that there were five mentions of the word affliction. That helped frame the kind of way we're going to create practice and ritual for the day of Yom Kippur. I expressed a little surprise again about how the rabbis present our current understanding of Yom Kippur, if you will, 2,000 years of Yom Kippur the way it is, that they didn't ask at the beginning of the tractate about what do we do the day before. Because there seems, as I mentioned to you in this tractate, there seems to be an understanding that Yom Kippur is more than just the 10th. Yom Kippur also includes the 9th, because the 9th is mentioned explicitly in the Torah as a day of engagement in terms of the Yom Kippur story. Where does the 9th fit in? How does the 9th fit in? Is going to be an essential piece of the material that we look at today in the next Mishnah of the chapter, which we're going to start with in terms of this second semester of looking at Yoma. Like I said, we have many Mishnayot to look at. We're going to start tonight with this Mishnah about what seems to be familiar material, but gets into this issue of, wait a minute, is there not more to Yom Kippur than the 10th itself? And we're going to look at what we can talk about, how we can talk about the 9th. In ritual theory kind of lens, again, I'm looking at some of the content of this tractate with you as material that was discussed, presented, thought about, and reflective of the great desire to create a life of rituals for the Jewish people that helped us express in the physical world, manifest in our spiritual lives internally and our physical engagements with Jewish ritual. These are some notes of the great grand committee who was debating about how we should engage in Yom Kippur. If Leviticus 23 outlines it and says five times the verb v'initem et nashrotechem, you should afflict your souls, we have to understand what does that mean. If the 9th is included, we understand what does the 9th mean. If there were already practices, this is where ritual theory comes in, if there were already practices and some suggestions of practices that the Grand Committee of rabbis, sages, wanted to consider, these are some of the notes of that great capital C committee. And I think what you'll see tonight, to give it away now in terms of the Gemara that's going to come on the heels of this Mishnah, is a question about whether or not the 9th is, could be, was, potentially, were people really extending the practices of the 10th already backwards to the 9th because of the mention of the 9th in the Torah? Or was there some kind of different practice that I did on the 9th vis-a-vis Yom Kippur and into the 10th? And on a wider kind of ritual theory level, the lens for us could be, is there a season of penitence that's being defined by some of the way they're looking at the 9th itself? Is there a longer period being defined, a period in which I engage in either very, very particular physical rituals or consciously relate to this time period as a period, right? Because the question really stands for us, when did the notion of Aseret Yemei Tshuva really come into being? The 10 days of repentance, right? It's not just a given. At some point, it doesn't say in the Torah, make for a 10-day period, even though it lists Rosh Hashanah and then it lists Yom Kippur. It doesn't really say that. So the question is, like, what kind of defining of this time period is going on in terms of what's evident, extant, in the text that we have in front of us? Okay, so some of those are going to be the questions that we look at as we get into this Mishnah on page 81A2.
What's the chapter?
The chapter is, we're in Yoma Kippurim, we're in Yoma, chapter 8, and it's 81A2 for the,
I got you.
81A is where you would be. Page 405.
Thank you. That's easier.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the next Mishnah in the Perek. And okay, here we go. Achal v'shata b'helem echad. If one ate and drank on Yom Kippur in a single period of unawareness. Now, it says below, either he did not know or he forgot that it was Yom Kippur, or he did not know or forgot that eating and drinking are forbidden on Yom Kippur. Those are two different things, right? Mm-hmm. Either he didn't know it was Yom Kippur, therefore he was kind of outside the framework of what? Of understanding Jewish time, wasn't really aware that the Beit Din had declared this was the Rosh Chodesh, and here we go with Yom Kippur and I'm not aware of it. Or, at this point in the Mishnah, in the history of the Jewish people, didn't really know that eating and drinking was forbidden. Why might that be, in terms of just pure Mishnah study, why might that be possible? Because the Mishnah is presenting for us sometimes some of the first glance at established practice or practices that are being established for commemorating the days we have in the Torah. And don't eat and don't drink is not said explicitly in Torah or in Tanakh. Remember, we made the connection in Psalm 35 between to fast and afflict the soul. But the Mishnah is very generous here and says perhaps the person doesn't really have this practice on Yom Kippur yet. We told you in the first Mishnah, by the way, that you're not allowed to eat. And that was an expression of afflict your soul. But very interesting, sometimes the Mishnah really does that innocently present a possibility. The question is, what does Behelem Echad mean? He didn't know that it was the month of Tishrei and it was the 10th right now. He didn't know that eating and drinking was part of it. Or, what's the root? What do we use that root for in modern Hebrew?
Le'alem, not to be.
Le'alem. It either disappeared or le'italem mize. Ignore it. Ignore it. I mean, there's
Hebrew, yes, but here?
There's all kinds of possibilities with Helem, and whether or not it's by conscious ignorance, meaning
it's gulped
ignore.
Down, you gulp it down, you're like, boom, ne'elam, gone.
Right, so something that's ne'elam imcha is gone.
No, but the food is gone in one
yeah, that too, right? In one single gulp. Okay. In other words, do you ever have those moments in your experience where you were conscious about the day, the time, the activity that you're even in, and all of a sudden you literally feel transported either mentally or you've done something to demonstrate that you really weren't there? Anybody have this experience beside me? I mean, I hope this is human.
I think it's universal.
I hope so.
But, like, not for this situation.
Not for Yom Kippur?
Yeah, I can't see that being such a...
Are they referring to someone living within the Jewish community?
Oh, for sure.
This could happen, or someone just traveling and not being aware?
This is living within the Jewish community. I think what this, you know, it's just on the spiritual, psycho-spiritual, Chavayat Chaim, experience of life level. I have to say, like, I've been involved in pretty significant ritual life for a long time. Now and then, even in those moments of really serious ritual life, I find myself saying, wow, like, you really weren't there for a moment. Mm-hmm. whether it's like something that I'm thinking about and I have this,
distracted.
You know, it's a distraction entirely, or I'm literally transported somewhere else. And it's happened to me on Shabbat. I can't say recently, but I'm willing to admit that on Shabbat, I'm so determined to be thinking about something that I need to get done, or that is on my, you know, it's on my calendar to get done. And I found myself so deeply involved in that kind of thing that I just had to run and make a note about it, which is a practice I have all over the place. Little notes to myself all over the place, and pads all over the place. And I like the Galaxy Notes. You take out the little stylus and you put. And it's not that it happens regularly, but it happened to me on a Shabbat.
The real question is whether it happens when you're leading services.
No. I mean, during the daily menu, by the way, I will allow myself to wander in and out of that space. And sometimes people see me at my feet and I'm scratching something, or I'm typing something in. Because for me, tefillah, by the way, it works for me a little bit like that. That I can be kind of in the space of davening, and then all of a sudden, I'll really have a concept or an idea or a way to express whether it's an upcoming eulogy or it's literally an idea that I want to pursue, a programming kind of thing.
Happens to me every Monday morning.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's how davening kind of works sometimes, when we let our brains have that downtime. For those of you who come, just as a sidebar, is that at all an experience?
I think, well, mornings are when you do a lot of consolidating after sleep. That's when you're most integrating information and consolidating memory and creating connections.
Mm-hmm.
I think almost the guy who first said, let me sleep on that,
was right.
He was right.
Nice. Well, this guy seemed to have gone to sleep during Yom Kippur.
Yeah, well, that's a little different. But I was also wondering if this could be people who had cognitive decline in those days, when he says that they were unaware of it.
Interesting.
You know, is this the elderly population that, you know, is sort of losing track of these things? I'm just, you know, I'm confabulating here.
Yeah.
The way it's written just raised that idea in my mind.
That's a nice question. What were you going to say, Dale?
I was thinking of somebody with a fever. Is it similar?
Interesting.
Same category.
Interesting. Well, in any which way, we're not exactly sure. The Gemara doesn't go into it, and there's no Rashi to explain exactly what happened, which is why the note down below, there's some exploration of that in sources, and given our attention to some of the modern realities that we've come upon and defined for ourselves, not surprising that we would come up with some more. Meanwhile, the whole idea is that it was one time, and the Mishnah says, "Eino chayav ela chatat echad." He's only liable to bring one chatat offering, meaning that the affliction of that eating and drinking, if you did it at one time, even though we said, remember that they don't combine to make the measure, well, they combine here as eating and drinking to kind of be one issue in terms of a chatat. Okay, that's the kind of chiddush of the mitzvah. Achal v'asa melacha, if you ate and you did a melacha, meaning that you violated the statute about doing no labor, which is forbidden on the day, and you also ate, which is one of the inui nefesh, chayav chatot. He's obligated a guilt offering for the eating, which is an inui nefesh, and a guilt offering for the malacha, which you violated. That's going to come to life because you have separate psukim.
This is really in the alternative. They really mean or, right? They don't mean you have to do both. Just, in other words, I didn't eat and drink, I only ate.
I think
they mean an or, right?
No, I don't think so.
No,
I think that actually the first clause
are totally separate.
I
think the first clause is a combined.
So if I only ate, okay. If I only drank, I'm okay.
Well, that's the thing. You could ask on a level of like that kind of Talmudic logic. If I only did one, then what are you saying, right? I think the answer of the to that premise would be, go back to the first Mishnah, the last few pages that we were on before we broke, and see what kind of measurement we're talking about.
I don't
really
be clever about it.
Those aren't clever. Those are the kind of questions that we sometimes find right in the Gemara itself. Right? That's the way we parse things. Achal ochalin she'enan re'uyin le'achila. Now, what about eating foods that are unfit for eating? In other words, I
thought everything was unfit for eating.
Right. If you look at the note, it says, such as bitter herbs or spoiled meat.
Oh, they don't mean like ham.
Okay? So, that's one way of looking at it. Simply thinking, again, Mishnaically, without being informed by Rashi and having to always use his defining, he has the oral tradition. Let's say that you feel so hungry, you want to still fast, you pick up a twig, and you chew on it, but you wind up ingesting some of it. Question is, am I chayav? It's kind of satisfied me because I needed the physiology of chewing, eating, and just through the masculation, I was able to satisfy my hunger. Right? Am I chayav? V'shata mashkin she'enan re'uyin lishtia. And I needed something in my mouth more than what? The cheekful that we talked about? Because we're remembering that we already have some measurements over here from the first Mishnah. V'shata tzir o murayas, such as he drank fish brine or dissolved fish fats. That's to make it totally unappetizing for us, by the way. Right? But some people really like that pickled herring juice.
You've satisfied yourself. How have you afflicted yourself?
But Pator, he's exempt. Because the Mishnah here wants to help us find a way not to make someone liable for karet. Not to cut you off. And this gets into the whole outlook of halakha. The whole notion of where we are, the nitiyah, the tendency to really try to say, no, there's absolutely no space for you to do this, or else you will be cut off from your people. Karet, this is a violation of Torah, of law, of the Mida Araita. That informs more than one or another groups these days, right? That they're either going to make this decision, or are we going to go the real machmir? Where are we going to make for some allowance? And are we going to have it be karet, or are we going to have it be a chatat? Look at what happened here. Because the person forgot, there's no karet involved. There's no excommunication entirely. Death at the hands of the heavenly court. There's a chatat often. Right? Because I say it's something that's not fitting to eat, and it's not really fitting to really drink, but you're trying to get through the day, and you've done it, and it was desperation. It sounds to me like there's desperation in this Mishnah to kind of get yourself over that hump. There's chatat. And then there's even, wait a minute, there's not even a need for chatat. There's not even a guilt offering associated with that. You're patur. You're exempt. It's much more affirming. What?
We're talking about if you have the twig or the thing that's not really food, you're patur?
Yeah. You're not liable.
People tend to do that as a result?
Well, that's what's interesting is that that's where the end of, we're going to now look at the Talmud, that's the end of this part of the Gemara before we get to the next Mishnah. It's really fascinating because we wouldn't think it should be allowed.
I could see some
right?
Yeshivas. Like
not even that, even by us. Even by us, Bobby.
Yeah.
Don't we really feel like if I see someone taking out, a stick of ginger, right? It's part of that real thick root of ginger. If I saw someone chewing on a stick of ginger, not that they're going to do it right in the middle of the service, but I wouldn't really expect that in our tradition it would be allowable to do this. And as moderns, even people not so associated with everyday ritual life, I would say, like, no, there's no space for that. But in the committee notes, there's really space for some of this stuff. There's really a deep understanding of humanity here. Is my overarching point. And when you take that away, from halachic decision making and what's permitted even on a day like Yom Kippur vis-a-vis the fast, you don't get the full spirit of the law. Now, I'm not saying be overly permissive, but we'll see in today's section that it's a very interesting question as to how much leniency is there. How much exemption am I willing to write in?
I think that the mechanism of the chatat is built in. So you digress, and then you have a way of repenting in some way, and it's built into the ritual.
Right. Even
nowadays,
if
we don't really have that.
Oh, sure we do.
Well,
we go, we put a little tzedakah in, we went to Minyan once, we feel good.
To feel good, but that is more formalized.
Well, it's definitely more formalized than the past, no doubt.
It's like
more formalized.
It is defined.
Yes.
Even the digression.
I would agree.
Why, when you have got punishment of karat, for karat of an action, why we, the rabbis, added a chatat?
Yeah, because they're basically moving us away from karat, because they're using the notion of really doing it as having...
You don't do it on Shabbat.
You do sometimes, because what you see here is a way of looking out for what your transgressions really mean vis-a-vis Shabbat or Yom Tov or Yom Kippur.
So the human rabbis can eliminate God's punishment of karet.
The human rabbis are definitely in dialogue with God about the humanity of the human beings that are trying to express to the best of their ability God's will, and we create that system to revise and renew, most definitely.
So why they don't do it on Shabbat?
Well, they do in a certain way.
I mean, I never saw somebody being punished by driving on Shabbat.
Right, so the question is, at what level are you talking about punishment, right? If you believe that you can still create a Shabbat spirit by having people drive, a Shabbat spirit, there has been some type of work within the realm of the last 100 years where we've had cars and experienced mass transportation to try to understand how we still celebrate Shabbat and not give up on the Ruach Shel HaShabbat in addition to the driving. Now, conservative movement, this is going to seem very much into the prot of the driving issue, but it's very much an answer to your question. If I take seriously the notion of the investigation of how to make driving possible, but for the reality of keeping Shabbat and that cultural part of our Jewish people alive, I personally have much more room in my heart for thinking about driving on the Sabbath, right? The rabbis, too, want to keep Yom Kippur on the radar of the Jewish people. They know that certain human beings are going to have this moment of this partial lapse, whether it's cognitive decline or some kind of fever or other experience that leads me to it, or it's simply I'm a little bit of a space cadet. I'm aware that this might happen, and the rabbis are aware, and they say, well, that seems to be a different action than being chote and over al ha'inui. And so they take that and they build on that. And if it works in our system to build on that, to keep the spirit of Yom Kippur, to keep the spirit of the Torah, they're going to do it. It's like a Rav Melchior, get back to your driving. Rav Melchior is part of a party that believes that Torah law can be applied to modern Israel. And we have to look for the possible and not just say, lo efshari, bilti efshari. Not possible. So what he started to investigate in the mid-90s was a system to put the buses into action on the Sabbath.
You mean Meimad?
Yeah, Meimad. I don't even know if they're still really organized.
No, now they are trying to put the Chokam Arkulim. They are trying to impose Shabbat everywhere.
Yeah, I saw some of the recent dialogue with the United Torah of Judaism.
Right,
but that just means the Sicha is still alive. That means the conversation is alive.
Well, it's Haifa, by the way. I think through Malkiel's work, personally.
Yeah.
The best thing.
Yeah. So I think the space here in the Mishnah is that space that we're talking about now, even though the issues are so distinct and apart. Right? And if I happen to grab the wrong wallet and take money with me when I jumped on the bus because that's an everyday kind of action that I do for the sake of my work, and I'm going could I see the rabbi saying that that's kind of a different level than a karet? It's a level of chatat because of my forgetfulness. Yeah, that's the way our system works.
I wonder if God agrees with the rabbi.
Well,
the problem.
Yeah. So when you get up there, you'll ask.
I understand what the people are saying.
The assumption is it's only if it's done by error. If it's done intentionally, eating on Yom Kippur, even a small amount, this does not apply.
Right. I think that this is talking about periods or episodes
even
or situations.
You need that little extra.
Yeah, and there are different ways that the Gemara already, we saw, dealt with when we needed the little extra and how you could have a mouthful or how you could eat this. And again,
but that's intentional.
Yeah. Right. Which is why they warned you with only so much before. All right. So let's push into the Gemara now and see what are the issues that are going to come up. I already tipped you off. A, we're going to talk about, like, as an assumption that the Gemara is going to make, that you're relating to the ninth day question. It's on the table. B, this notion of what do you chew on will be the two areas that we're going to look at. Okay. Reish Lakish Amar. Amar Reish Lakish. For what reason was a scriptural warning, i.e. a negative commandment, not stated explicitly with regard to affliction on Yom Kippur? In other words, let's put it like this. It says five times, v'initim et nashotechem. It doesn't say, lo le'achol ve'lo lishtot. It doesn't say, don't eat and don't drink. In other words, the warning is not explicit. And it doesn't even have a phrasing of, be very careful not to do any actions that would be considered transgressions, meaning that you would not be afflicting yourself. It doesn't state it like that, to double down on what it is that we are defining as the ways to afflict yourself. So there's all kinds of questions. Well, if it's not so clear, can I be so ready to mete out punishments? Punishments here are as deep and bad as karet, as deep and impactful as karet, being cut off. Punishments are also, if I have liability, they could be punishments that come with lashes. There's a principle, a basic principle in Talmudic literature that says, if I'm going to have punishments that include lashes, I must have some type of warning, explicit warning, against that which is forbidden. So this is what's in the backdrop of Reish Lakish's question. Can this system really work?
For any punishment?
For corporal and capital punishment.
Okay.
Now, Amar Reish Lakish, she says, for what reason was a scriptural warning and negative commandment not stated explicitly with regard to affliction? Mishum de lo efshar, because it's not possible to phrase the commandment to afflict oneself as a negative commandment. In other words, I couldn't say, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. It needs to be in the positive, afflict yourself. Hechi nichtov. For how should the Torah write it? Nichtov rachamana lo yocha. Wait a minute. So you want to ask me how the Torah should write it if I want to don't do it? I'm going to tell you exactly how to write it. Right? This is rabbinic chutzpah. Let God say. Let the Torah state it this way. Right? That's all doable, possible, good in Jewish debate. Good Jewish debate. Nichtov rachamana lo yocha. This is like license, by the way, for all parents when they're looking at their children's essays to change anything, like, or to suggest any kind of change. This is really part and parcel of the big project. Nichtov rachamana lo yochal. Should the merciful one write in the Torah, one shall not eat on Yom Kippur? Achila b'chazayit. That would not be possible because the term eating, we've already looked at this, right, in the literature that we studied before. If I only wrote eating, I would think that any eating is involved. It wouldn't be the kind of eating that I need to tell you about when I'm talking about rabbinic eating, which is anything less than a chazayit was considered not to be eating, right? Right? We remember that when we said? We could say eating, but we didn't really mean eating. We're allowing for a little bit of tasting, ingesting. You might get the wrong idea. That it would be completely forbidden. Nichtov rachamana lo tune. Well, okay. So let the merciful one in the Torah say, do not be afflicted, phrasing affliction in negative terms. Kum echol mashma. This would imply get up and eat, though. Thus the Torah had to phrase the affliction precept as a positive commandment. To what? Afflict your soul. And then we had to come along, in other words, in the Mishnah and tell you, what does it mean to afflict your soul? The Gemara objects to that. Makifla Rav Hoshaya. Rav Hoshaya objects to that. Nichtov Rachamana Hishamer Pen Lo Tune. Let the merciful one write in the Torah, be vigilant lest you not be afflicted. Clever, right? Guard yourselves against coming to the state of not being afflicted, in other words. Here's how that works. That the negative way of saying it, Hishamer Pen Lo Tune, means
Ishamer is the positive.
It's kind of like this. Be vigilant lest you not afflict your souls. Imkain Nefishi Lehu Laive. If the Torah had written it like that, there would be abundance of negative commandments associated with the affliction precept. Because we still say that would be like a negative. Let it not be. That you don't do this. But no, this is about a positive commandment on the day. Now, one could stop here and... Well, one could stop here and talk about what's the difference, really. Is there a difference between a lo tase and an ase, and where do they fall in terms of rabbinic mitzvah philosophy? So that's a bigger topic than I want to get into tonight, but that is part of what's going on here. The discussion of, is it more impactful, more precise to say that these mitzvot are positive versus negative, and how does doing a positive mitzvah on Yom Kippur really impact the day versus refraining from something? So if I say that I'm refraining from eating and drinking, is that the same as I am afflicting my soul or answering some question about my soul life based on the positive engagement of my fast?
It's very interesting, because if you just think about Yom Kippur, you do not think about it as all negative. You know, I mean, that's just our general tendency. I don't eat, I don't drink, I don't do this, I don't do that. So to put this in a positive is a very interesting reversal of the way we usually conceptualize it.
It is.
And there are positives for not doing all of that.
So general agreement, would everybody say it's even a reversal of how we think about it?
This is really a double negative when you really think about it. It's not really a negative.
Correct, it's a double negative.
It's still
for the Gemara would be a negative commandment. A don't do something. A lo tase. Now a lo tase mitzvah doesn't necessarily mean that it's quote unquote negative as in don't do, but here it kind of is, even with a double negative. So that's the difference.
Well, this is not it's the difference between a commission and an omission, right?
Right. But it's also the difference of how I expressed it before, unless somebody else has a better way of expressing it. There's a difference between you shall not eat in terms of the philosophy of action, right? And I shall afflict my soul by engaging this practice of fasting. And the question is, meaning-wise, meaning, does that have a meaningful difference?
Absolutely. I mean, not eating is an act. Afflicting your soul has got a whole psychological dimension to it that's well beyond a physical act. I mean, it puts the onus on you for, obviously, in your community, of course, but defining what's an affliction of your soul. But the goal isn't for you not to be eating. The goal is for you to be thinking about afflicting yourself in the context of repentance.
Right. Right. Let's see how they expand on the conversation. So we're just going to do a little bit more of a part of this before we jump to the next piece of Gemara too. So Matkiv la Rav Bivi Bar Abaye. Rav Bivi Bar Abaye objects to him and says, Nichtav rachamana hishamer mitzvot inui. Let the merciful one write in the Torah, be vigilant with regard to the commandment of affliction. In other words, make sure that you are really taking this mitzvah seriously. Im ken hishamer de love, hishamer de ase. If the Torah had written it so, we would apply the rule that be vigilant pertaining to a prohibition constitutes a prohibition, whereas be vigilant pertaining to a positive commandment constitutes a positive commandment. Another objection. Matkif la Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi objects to it. Nistov al tasur min ha'inu. We let the Torah write, do not turn aside from affliction. The Gemara writes, right? Kasha, just to show you. They're not really sure then. If the Torah couldn't have said it a little differently, kasha is different than kind of arriving at teku, which is, this is not decided and one day it will be. It's not that we present one of the answers at the end and say tiyuvta, like there's a solution. Kasha.
That's
the end of that little part.
Really,
that's very little part. Now, it's not that we're not going to continue talking about the warning piece, but this next section is going to present a Tana, which comes to, this is a Tanaitic source in a Midrashic work, there's a parallel to it, which also relates to this ninth day issue, which is my interest in the next passage. So now put yourself in the mindset of whether it's a positive or a negative commandment. If I have a positive or negative commandment that I think is really meaningful, and let's say we're early on in the development of the practices around Yom Kippur, and I say, from what I sense from Scripture, that the ninth is mentioned in addition to the Etzim Hayom, to the essence of the day itself, which would be the tenth in this case, if we're counting on the calendar, might I want my practices that I define for the day, that are linked to the verbs that are used in this scripture, this part of scripture, might I want those to last for more than just one day's worth of time? Might I want them to come into focus and into practice for more than just the one day, especially if I have a mention of the ninth in scripture? So I think what we're seeing, what we're going to see here in some of this next material is the question of whether or not there wasn't an expanded period of time for some of what we call what you do on Yom Kippur. Now, retrojecting, I could not find the exact start date of this practice, but I know it's very early from Masechet Tani. There are those who fast more than once in a week when we're really in need of asking God to send rains for the land of Israel. Right? There are fasts of Monday and Thursday in our tradition. There are 3 days of fasting in our tradition that people take on 3 days of fasting. It's kind of sunrise to sunset fasting. In the lives of religious communities throughout the ages, you can see that fasting, and we had an article that we read from towards the beginning of the semester, fasting was not only decreed for any given holidays that had fasts associated with them, or commemorative days in our case, because the prophets say that there are four fasts, right? The four fasts, the Tevet, the fast of Gedalia. Esther's actually not one of the four, interestingly enough. I'll tell you why in a second. Fast of Tam was the fast of Av. Esther itself, as a book, mentions it, so they don't need to kind of refer to these four other historical ones. And for that reason, the fast of Esther is treated differently in halachic literature as a fast that's much easier to skip out on if you need to, for whatever purpose. Not that the other fasts, the minor fasts, are also, in terms of halachic literature, fasts that you don't really have to do if you're feeling ill or sick. But on the fast of Esther, if you have the slightest headache, you know, you really shouldn't overdo it, because Purim's coming and you want to be ready to hear the Megillah and you want to be ready for the holiday itself. All that said, fasting is used by later traditions as well. You've heard of Ramadan and the notion of having daily fasts and breaking those fasts with meals on a continuous basis. So I'm not suggesting that the system back at the rabbinical era looked like any kind of development of Islamic law about Ramadan. What I am saying is that fasting in and of itself is a practice that makes for meaning in religious life. And the Gemara makes evident that perhaps there were those who thought, maybe we want to add a little bit more to the fast. Maybe we really want to afflict ourselves and fast for a longer period of time.
This is all about fences. I mean, you know, I think that's part of the tradition. And the defining feature of how far out you build the fence is, I think, a fascinating discussion of the way in which people look at religious law.
Right. So if it's about the fence and how far out you build the fence, I could see that. Also about the state of mind that you're in by the end of the experience. You know, because ni'ila...
If you continue more than... I know you can survive more than 24 hours, but if you're eating sticks for 24 hours, what are you going to be doing 48 hours?
They're giving in to the temptation of denying themselves.
Interesting. Said in the negative. Or the positive.
At a certain point, you're damaging God's creation ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be really mindful about that. I mean, it's one thing to the line between devotion and piety and health-related issues. I think you've got two very, very powerful opposing aspects to this.
Right, so, and sanctity of life, by the way, will become part of the very serious discussion post the next Mishnah. And where do we draw the lines? Where do we draw the lines in terms of appreciating the sanctity of life, and how far do we go to protect it, and what do we ultimately have at stake?
Right, so we got two sets of fences.
So, all right, so hold on for that. Foreshadowing. But here, let's go to this Tannaitic source. V'tana maiti la mehach. And a Tana derives it, in other words, the warning against eating and drinking on Yom Kippur, from here. V'initim v'chol melacha lo tasu. V'initim. I was looking for where the rest of that phrase was. V'initim et nashotechem, and v'chol melacha lo tasu. Torah states, you shall afflict yourselves, and you shall not do any work. Yechol yehe anush al tosefet melacha. It might be thought that one is punished with karet on account of additional period work that he does. Meaning, if you did work and you didn't add a time during the weekday period or the period just before Yom Kippur, you didn't add from the ninth day a time that you stopped your work and did the right thing vis-a-vis Yom Kippur, it might be thought that you could get karet for it. Talmud Lomar, v'chol ha-nefesh asher taseh chol melacha ba'etzem ha-yom hazeh. But I can't really say that there's an added period, a tosefet of time an added period of time where you have to refrain from doing the labors that are forbidden, because the verse goes on to say, on this very day. And it's only on that very day, if you do those malachot, those labors, that then it leads to your being excommunicated. But the premise, my interest is in the premise of the Braita. Early level source saying, oh, maybe it's about the work you did during what? The Tosefet period. The added period. Wait a minute. Did I hear anywhere to add a period where I don't do work on Yom Kippur? Where did I hear that? Ah, there's a certain assumption or a certain built-in feature here of the Yom Kippur experience that's now coming to light, that says there's a Tosefet, there's some additional period that I've got to understand. Like, what's this additional period? Al itzumo shel yom anushkaret. It teaches on account of doing work on the very day, meaning the 10th, that one is punished with karet. Ve'eino anushkaret al Tosefet melacha. But he's not given karet on account of the additional period work that he does. Again, additional period, not defined.
This very day construction in Hebrew, does that appear anywhere else?
Etzim hayom hazeh?
Yeah.
Yeah. That appears in the giving of the Torah. That appears...
Of the holidays?
Oh, yeah, of the holidays, I think...
Isn't it in the Haggadah?
I don't have my my little concordance not fired up. I don't have battery. But we'll find out. We'll find out where it appears. That's in my Amazon.
That construction seems... maybe just different English translations, so I don't know.
Yeah. But
that seems... different from what I remember from the other holidays, but maybe.
Well, let's look for it. I'll do a search. Yachol lo yehe anush karet al tosefet malacha. It might be that one is not punished with karet on account of additional period work. Aval yehe anush karet al tosefet inui. But one is punished with karet on account of additional period affliction that he fails to keep. Again, for not beginning the fast on where? The 9th of Tishrei, prior to the commencement of Yom Kippur. So even though I'm not talking about a full-out period of time like a Seret Yimei Tshuva here, I am working with this Tanaitic source with an assumption that I've got some addition and that it's talking about the 9th. Which for me is just... again, ritually important to know which days are holiday.
This is, I'm not pushing it, but all it's pointing out that the holiday starts on the 9th in the evening. I'm not sure that it's going beyond saying that we're reckoning this from that day, that very day, from evening to evening.
Yeah, but in the afternoon you need to start to stop, and korban, I think you cannot eat it after a certain amount of time.
Right, but I'm just looking at the text.
So it starts like in 3 afternoon.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying I'm looking at the English translation here of the Torah text. Or it says this, it is a Sabbath of rest for you, and you shall afflict yourselves on the 9th of the month in the evening.
Right.
Evening until evening, you shall rest your Sabbath. So it identifies the 9th, but it looks to me like it's just starting the day of the 10th, the 9th, the evening of the 9th.
Right, the end of the evening of the 9th. Right. So you can say that.
Error.
Right.
But you're saying there's nothing here that is so obvious to me that you need to do anything until the evening of the 10th, the beginning of the 10th.
They talk about an addition, so where would that be? So I'm wondering whether the additional time is the 9th, but then you can eat before starting. So maybe that day...
Well, that is what they're going to say, remember?
But the evening is the 10th.
Right.
Right. Evening meaning nightfall.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's really what I'm saying is I don't see anything here that has any obligation on the ninth, even though the ninth is mentioned.
Right, and what the Gemara is suggesting...
Wait, where do you see the ninth? Is that...
The ninth is in the verse that's quoted...
That's what I just read. This says, and you shall afflict yourselves on the ninth of the month in the evening, from evening until evening you shall
rest. It's verse 32 of Leviticus 23, verse 32. It's down. We have the verses down below. You don't have them there. That's not just
thank
nice.
You.
It's in the notes.
I thought you were saying it's in the Gemara.
But we're remembering that. So here's the. I know we're saying it. There is nothing obvious that says do anything on the ninth. Yet what I'm pointing out is the Gemara, the Tanaitic source, knows of some Tosefet. It's not talking about the 11th. It's using the ninth as being the time when there's something else, there's some other period of time. And by the way, if I'm liable for karet, if I'm liable to be excommunicated for either work I might have done or for not keeping some affliction that I'm responsible for on the added amount of time, boy, I have to know what that added amount of time is and where it comes from, right? Only makes sense that it would come on the ninth because it actually mentions the ninth in verse 32 of chapter 23 in Leviticus. But it didn't really make sense to us yet because, by the way, there's no Mishnah that said here's what you do on the ninth, as we've pointed out before, and we did page forward already, and we know what's coming, the big to-do, that eating on the ninth, just before the fast of the tenth, is considered what?
Inui,
as if you fasted. And we've said this, you know, we'll say it again. Like, we are the ones to say that eating is the affliction, in addition to fasting, which is the affliction. I mean, it works for us this way, except my real contention is that perhaps this is the kind of discussion that was around to say, maybe you needed a little bit more of a period where you didn't do any malacha, not just the 10th. Maybe it was just the 9th. Maybe there's even more of a period for that. It doesn't really define it. Maybe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, somebody was sitting there thinking, you know, we should have 10 days where we really say to people, you know, completely stop and do this. No, we can't do that. Why? Because Sukkot is coming.
Yeah, well, I find this strange because my instinct is to think of Judaism as really trying to find very discrete divisions when you go from one point to another point and try to avoid any sloppiness of oozing things, that you really want to know when things are. So this, I think, runs counter to what I've always taken to be one of the tenets of trying to define holy time.
I agree with you. That ooziness interests me. Whether it was as oozy as I'm making it out to be, I'm not guaranteeing it. I for sure think that it might be just a hava mina, as the Gemara goes. In other words, let's put this up there. If you're going to get this in such a fuzzy place, you're going to push this into such a fuzzy place, no one's going to know how to really celebrate this holiday, so you better get as distinct and determinate as you ever were, and that really will be what happens in this discussion.
So, at least according to this, I'm working on a negative here, there's no halacha related to this Tosefet, so...
Not yet.
What are we
waiting for? Just to finish the thought, that says that it didn't get taken forward as a halakha, but I think you're suggesting that it was a practice, it wouldn't have been mentioned.
I think you're right to say as of now and for the future that the Tosefet of Yom Kippur vis-a-vis malacha and fasting did not get carried forward. You're right. Interestingly, the way that they will carry it forward in whatever way this is a carry forward of this particular concept or not is to say, I know what I'll say. here's going to be the halacha. We're going to say eating on the ninth is inui. Eating on the ninth is inui, just like inui is fasting on the tenth. It says, if you fasted on the ninth, remember, that's the formula they're going to use. I mean, it's just...
And that last meal becomes a holiday meal.
Right. So, in your book, it's page 408, and since we're already there, let's just turn to it so that we can do a little bit more in other kind of Gemara tonight. I just want to show you where it's said again. Tana de Etzem Etzem is where we're going towards, and it is... on 81B. Here, 81B2, for those with the art scroll. Yeah. Just listen to this. V'tana de etzim etzim, and the Tana the Braita cited above, who expounds the expressions this very day, hai batisha l'chodesh, with regard to what do we do with this Tisha L'Chodesh in terms of trying to figure out what kind of Tosefet it means and what should we do? Should we say legislate no malacha, no laborers? Should we legislate no eating, no drinking? No. My avid lay, you know, what are we going to do with this? Mi baile lechitane chiyabarav midifti. He needs that verse... for the exposition of the Brayta of Chiya Bar Rav Difti, which teaches the Tanei Chiya Bar Rav Medifti, he says, this teacher, V'initim enasho techem v'tisha, the Torah states, you shall afflict yourselves on the ninth, v'chi v'tisha mitanin, but is it on the ninth of the month of Tishrei that we fast? V'halo ba'asor mitanin. Why, it's the tenth of Tishrei that we fast. And why then does the verse say the ninth? Eila lomar lecha, that's to tell you or teach you, kol ha'ochel v'shotei v'tisha'i. Anyone who eats or drinks on the ninth, ma'alei alav ha'katuv, that's as if Scripture can be afforded to him, or Scripture, he reflects what Scripture is saying in this sense, ki'ilu hitana tish'i v'asiri. That's as if he had fasted on the ninth and the tenth. So if he eats on the ninth, it's as if he had fasted on the ninth and the tenth. He gets a double day of credit fast for having a nice good meal on the ninth before the holiday begins. And that is to answer, though, because before I just told you that it was about the ninth and what we do on the ninth. Ha! It's more than that. It's to answer the scriptural problem of the mention of the Tishi, the scriptural notion of why the scripture mentions the ninth, plus this notion that maybe I want to add time of doing the actual practices that I do on the tenth in order to make my Yom Kippur deeper, more impactful, powerful, focal. You know, it will focus me in a different way. But no, I don't do it with those particular practices. I do it by eating. I do it by eating. And it's accounted for me as if I fulfilled everything in Torah and I fasted on 2 days.
Can you do melacha on the tree?
Yeah.
At night?
At night.
So maybe it's the catch-up. So because people don't work on the Yom Kippur, they say, okay, finish your work and whatever on the tree and... then you can have a day off. Maybe it's a catch-up day.
If you really make the ninth a day of not just preparation, but you're serious about preparing for Yom Kippur, there have been other developments on the ninth, right? If we were to study different sources throughout halachic history or customs, kind of reflections on customs of what people do on the ninth before Yom Kippur, you would see that there's a couple of different areas. One, you have to spend a great amount of time and pay great attention to creating a meal that would be appropriate for your Suda Masek, right? For your meal before Yom Kippur. Two, there is the tradition of going to the mikveh for both men, particularly it was for men throughout the kind of writings that we're talking about, of going to mikveh and using that day to prepare spiritually. Three, mincha time becomes a time of either, and this is a very interesting notion, a practice run for your confession, because the mincha before Yom Kippur, which is usually prayed a little earlier by way of how it's now come out of tradition, and there's a whole halachic history of whether or not we're going to put it close to Kol Nidre, or we're going to daven during the day. So we call mincha here even for 1:15 in the afternoon, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the tradition of saying mincha and saying a full confession at mincha. So you have the liturgy there. Is it for practice? Is it because the day itself is certain holiday status without it being a Yom Tov? There are those poskim who will tell you it's because it's the holiday status. And it's already got this element of Yom Kippur in it that you're saying that confessional. And there are those who will say, no, 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 it's really the Hachanah. It's as if I commemorated the 9th and the 10th. And so here is part of a little bit more than as if I'm actually saying the confession. And it's an interesting way to engage the 9th of the month of Tishrei in addition to the 10th. If you do more than just have the meal before Yom Kippur.
But I think they were concerned that the self-affliction would get out of hand and would encourage people who were zealots to extend all of this. So I think this seems to me to be a very, very creative way of overcoming that by, in essence, telling them that it would be unpious if they extend their fast or begin their fast prematurely.
Well said, I agree. I think that what comes out of here is a kind of recognition of our human capacity and inclination to become a little bit more focused on the self-inflicted affliction within the religious experience. And they didn't want that level of withdrawing from normative human endeavor, normative life, to extend for more than the day's worth of time that they really were going to put it on the map. And in their hermeneutical creativity, they brought it down, saw the word etzim, which is the interesting term that you're asking, where do we use this, right? At least this other verse, and we didn't do all the work, but there's this other verse that mentions it. So you have etzim etzim. And by really examining the notion that, no, this is truly one day, and if you want to include the ninth,
right,
here's a way to include the ninth.
But then we're back to a very clean division.
Nachon, correct. And that's a religious imagination that likes very distinct Chol and Kodesh, Shabbat and days of the week, right? But it's yet a little gray by way of what we put in our mouths on Yom Kippur, and here's the next part. So take a look at this. This to me is fun. This to me is.
We are
now.
We are going to get
right at the bottom of 81B2. No, we're going to be right there. 81B2. And page 409. Okay. What's that?
I have a picture,
yes,
so
yes.
I know where you're going.
Yes.
Ginger plant.
Yes. So this is going to be this version of the Talmud that Dale has that I have up here as well is the Steinsaltz version of the Talmud, and inside this version on many of the pages he'll bring some realia by way of background or language, and oftentimes there are pictures. We've had a couple of these. I've handed out a couple.
The picture book version is much
better.
Which version?
The picture book
version is much better. Well, let me tell you, it's very heavy.
Yes, that's very true. Very true. Okay. I think the last picture we used, by the way, if you recall, was of the sandal. You recall that?
Yes.
There was the sandal. Okay. So here we go. Achal ochalin she'ein ru'uyin la'achila. One ate foods that are unfit for consumption, you're patur. You're exempt. So ate foods that are unfit for consumption, what does that mean? Would I think that someone should eat something that even is not fit for consumption on Yom Kippur? Amar Rava says, Kas pil pele biyoma dechipuri patur. If one eats pepper berries on Yom Kippur, he's exempt. Pepper berries, by the way. What are pepper berries?
Peppercorns. Are they peppercorns?
Well, Rashi first of all says they're not usually eaten. So whatever they is, whatever they are, they're not usually eaten. Now, peppercorns, if they're peppercorns, like those little ones that are like green pepper, red pepper, do you ever see that now? Instead of just having the black pepper, they have the little pepper. I mean, you ever put one in your mouth?
Well, that's why you pay a
price. You pay a serious price. And how could you possibly, I mean, to me, that can't be the pepper berry that we're talking about. It just can't be. Because if you don't need a gallon of water, if you put one of those in your mouth, you need a gallon of water. So I think what it might be talking about are some form of pepper. And, you know, inside
sheet,
they have the white little seeds that are not like, they're not like cucumber seeds. They're not like tomato seeds that are, they have, they're very dry almost inside a pepper. And we know from peppers in the ancient world. And so I think what it means is this little white, almost what, I guess they're seeds, but sometimes even they have this styrofoamy substance.
That, are you talking about in green pepper?
I'm talking about, like, take a green pepper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking of like pepper.
They're seeds.
Okay.
They are seeds.
He says peppercorn.
I know he says peppercorn, but I can't agree.
I can't agree.
I mean, all due respect to Rabbi Steinsaltz in here, I simply can't believe that. The reason why he says peppercorn, I believe, is because of the next thing, which I do believe, though, because some people can handle ginger and some people can't. The next piece is he goes on, kas zangavila b'yoma kichipuri patur. Similarly, if one eats ginger on Yom Kippur, he's patur. So that to me makes a little bit more sense.
That's a very strong thing.
It's strong.
Now because of sushi, everybody eats it.
Eats it pickled, which is not.
Eats it pickled.
It's pickled, which is not quite as bad as.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, but I do think that ginger. So, by the way, so Rabbi Steinsaltz will say that pepper in Eretz Yisrael. This may refer to peppercorn, also called black pepper. The natural location for cultivation of this pepper is in tropical lands, and it's usually imported from India. However, there are isolated locations in Eretz Yisrael whose climate makes it possible to grow pepper. I would only ask him, what kind of other more bellish-like or chili pepper-like did we have in the ancient theater over there, and could those be the peppers we're talking about? And again, their little seeds are not the spicy part, per se. That said, the ginger plant and its flowers, semach hazingavil ufircho, ginger, which is called zingiber officinale, is a perennial tropical grass from the ginger family. Its height reaches 30 to 90 centimeters, and it has a thick aromatic rhizome. The plant originated in India, and it spread from there to other lands. The dried rhizomes are used as a spice for cakes, wines, various types of flour, various types of liquor. It's also used as a medicine, and it's sometimes held in the mouth to relieve bad breath. Now, that last point, I was once at a lecture about plants of the Bible and plants of the Talmudic era, and in terms of, you know how people have those little thin slices of what look like mint paper now? Do you ever see these things?
Listerine.
They're like,
they're like
little breath strips. So he told us that people sometimes would keep a little strip of ginger like that in their mouth to make sure that their breath didn't go in entirely bad. So that's the way it kind of, you can cut that into kind of a strip. Right. So is it that you put this in your mouth for the purpose of just your breath, or are you really chewing it? It sounds like you're chewing it here, because kas zingavila means that you're basically chewing it, not just letting it sit. Either which way, you're talking about a plant that is not necessarily used for eating in chunks, right? And you're talking about something very different.
So maybe it's because it's okay to accept yourself, but you don't want people flipping everything around you.
There you go. Yeah, keep your mouth shut. The Gemara challenges Rava's first ruling. Meitivei, so they retort with a Tanaitic source. Meitivei is going to introduce a Tanaitic, a very early layer source that has a lot of weight in terms of the ability to challenge with it. Hayah Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir would say, Mimash Mashinemar V'aralatem Orlato Et Pirio. From the implication of that which is stated, you shall treat its fruit as forbidden, meaning that when you come into the land and plant any tree, you shall treat the fruit as forbidden for 3 years. They shall not be eaten, meaning that's the mitzvah of orla, right? I let the trees grow for 3 years before I actually eat any of the tree. Do I not know that it is a food tree being discussed? I mean, come on, guys. Are we talking food or are we not talking food? Eila ma Talmud lo maretz machal. Rather, what teaching does the verse mean to convey by stating food tree? Et shita'am et sofir yoshave comes to include in the law of Orla a tree whose wood and fruit are equal in taste. Heve omer ze pilpilin. One must say that specifically this is the pepper tree, right? Because the taste of the fruit and the taste of the wood, if you will, they're both kind of similar. I guess that they had these little tree, you know, these pepper bushes. Remember that peppers don't grow on mega trees. They grow on these bushes that have this kind of stick, and then pepper stick, you know, they like a cinnamon bark, right? Cinnamon is really cinnamon bark in its official state, right? This is a Saudi Arabian Peninsula kind of spice. So pepper bark could also be very spicy in the ancient world, and they harvested some of it to use in addition to the berries. And the verse comes to teach you that peppers are subject to the law of Orla. So that verse comes to teach you the Orla. Ve'ein eretz Yisrael chaser klum. And it comes to teach you that the land of Israel is not lacking anything. She'ne'emar lo techsar kol ba. You won't lack anything in the land. And from that fact that raw pepper berries are included in the Orla prohibition, we see that they are regarded as a proper food. And therefore, what? How could you tell me that you're able to chew on such a proper food? Consumption puts the mind at ease. Why then does Rava exempt the chatas liability, one who eats pepper berries on Yom Kippur, if they're food? Right? Lo kasha. It's not difficult. Don't worry. Ha bertivta. This bride, which considers the pepper berry a food to which the laws of Orla apply, speaks of what? Moist pepper berries. V'ha b'veshta, and this ruling of Rava that eating raw pepper berries is abnormal speaks of the dry pepper berries which are used as spices and are not fit to be eaten. So, oh, by that time the Gemara comes back and that does say, you know what, we're really talking about pepper.
Peppercorn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just can't see it. I can't see someone on Yom Kippur.
That's crazy.
Really going, I mean,
That's why it's allowed.
Anybody ever go? I mean, peppermint is in and of itself too. Like, I know it's just the term pepper, but it made me think about the power of peppermint in its raw form. The plant itself, and then the extract that comes directly from the plant, is so powerful that if you really put some of it on your tongue, you would burn. You would just burn. Your eyes water. Your nose runs. I once went on a tour. Anybody ever goes here, I highly recommend it. In Colorado, in Boulder, mm-hmm. I went to the tour of the Celestial Seasonings Tea Company. And it was fantastic, and I saw how they cut the leaves, and they import this ingredient, and they have that little square, and they have these machines that mix those and blend those, and the flavor infusers when it comes to peach and their Sleepy Time mix, and this, and they have a special red door.
Red what?
A red door. Oh. And when the red door is closed, you're all fine. But if the red door is going to open, lights flash. You have to get at least whatever it is, 12 feet from the actual area around the door, because if they open it this much and the peppermint oils come into the air, literally your eyes can burn for the rest of the day, and you feel it in your sinuses. And, and so they open it up a little bit. They have us in the safe zone, and literally some people are so overwhelmed. You see their physical reaction, a reaction you can't it wasn't just an exaggeration. People really react. It's incredible, the smell and the power of the plant. I mean, so how a powerful plant can be used and not be real food, of course, it's not real food if it's so powerful.
Can you explain what they mean when they say, what is the practice of that?
Orla?
Yes, in trees.
Okay, so Orla is defined...
Or Shalosh Shanim.
Yeah. Orla is defined in Seder Zeraim in the Mishnah. And for different trees, you have to allow their fruits to simply fall down to the ground.
That's what it means?
You also have the different practices of... At a certain cycle within the tree's fruit giving, tying special ribbons or signs on different fruits to say this was year one, this was year two branch, this was year three. There's ways of tracking the fruit on a tree so that literally you're not eating.
So 3 years, I don't need to touch the fruit.
You're not eating.
It has nothing to do with shibut, with trying to merge two trees together so that it will be more fruitful.
It's all different practice. This is like
it's only not to eat the food.
Correct.
That's what
I
mean.
I recall that practice when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You didn't touch it. Actually, I think it comes to mind that not only do you not eat it, you just don't even allow the tree to produce that so that it can use the juices, the nutrients to build itself. So it's a process of letting the tree itself mature a little bit and then... enjoy the fruit.
I mean, from what I understand, some trees really don't give their fruit.
I don't remember which one, but I remember
I'm not sure that you can...
The etrog does not the first...
Yeah, you might have a way of keeping certain trees healthier by not allowing it.
Maybe vines or apple trees. I can't remember where, but...
I know that chesex, you're not supposed to eat 3 years because it's very bitter.
Citrus maybe.
Right, and some trees' fruit doesn't mature till then, so there's probably a combination between some of the natural fruit-giving abilities of trees and our desire to create a system whereby we're really engaged with a tree in terms of fulfilling mitzvah. Right.
I think agriculturally it makes for a better, crop.
I could only imagine, right? And because we notice something like an agricultural reality where you'll get a better crop and you'll get sweeter fruit, and we've quote-unquote ritualized it with agricultural practice that harkens back to Torah, that's what religion is for, right? To notice something in the world, to create ceremony around it sometimes, to create a process of engagement whereby we can recognize the power we have in our hands and the power that God put into the cycle.
So how the poor will know not to eat from that tree that the fruit is...
Yeah, they put special signs on it.
They put special signs.
Yeah.
I was just in Israel, I was in a kibbutz where they had the orange trees. I didn't see any signs, but they were clear to tell us don't eat these.
Oh, good. See, there you go. There you go. Yeah, of course, in Eretz Yisrael, it's going to happen in Eretz Yisrael. Welcome back, by the way. How long did you go?
We were there for about 11 days. But I had three of my grandkids, too, so it was a wonderful,
beautiful
trip. Yeah.
What part of the Mishnah or Talmud came alive for you?
It was just a great trip.
Terrific. You didn't run into Bobby and Barry in their clan.
No.
Yeah, we overlapped.
But I did hear it. Wait, not to make it all about trips, but thank God I hear more and more people heading off to Israel soon for good things. All right, so this is the part of the Gemara where there's some pepperberry and they're the foods that you can chomp on or keep around.
So I just wondered, in your experience, Rabbi, have you been in any congregation or any place in Israel where people are, using some of these allowable non-food?
Never in my life.
No, there is a tabak. There are some communities that use tabak.
Yeah, but not even for Yom Kippur. I've been in communities where, I think I told you before, where I use tabak, and they have rose water, and they come around with this strong-smelling...
To wake you up.
Rose water, to wake you up, literally, during the Torah service.
Yeah, I think it's to wake you up more than...
Sure.
You sniff it, though, right?
You sniff the... It's a very, very fine tobacco with wintergreen.
It's snuff.
Right. Right. Is that what all tobacco is called that's for smelling?
No. Snuff is inhaled, and you put it in this little portion.
Snuff box. But it's supposed to make you sneeze, which is the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
it clears your, and also clears your sinuses.
So this is what I've done. It cleared my sinuses, definitely. And it had wintergreen. A potent dose of wintergreen. They say more wintergreen than tobacco. How that really works, I don't know. Because I guess you can dry out a leaf and smash it as deeply as regular any tobacco leaf.
It's put in a powder with a mortar and pestle. It was very popular in the 1700s.
It was really interesting. For me, it was when I went and attended the Aleppo Shul, the Aleppo Synagogue in Nachlaot on a routine basis.
As a child, we had smelling salts, and it was used for people who were starting to feel faint from the fast. Not so much that they were sleepy, but...
In shul. Oh, wow.
So I remember
in the women's section. I don't know what they had in the men's section.
So I remember in the women's section of Orthodox shul when I was little, it was an orange or lemon that had cloves in it and smelled very aromatic, and the women who... supposedly, so they didn't feel faint, would take very lovely aromatic things, you know, just
cool.
With cloves in it. It was quite lovely.
Well, I think that it stems from right here. Even if you're not chewing on it, I think this is where it stems from.
Yeah, I mean, there was no suggestion of it, but it was just to smell. But, you know, women nowadays don't feel faint. They're very strong.
Yeah, we've noticed that.
Yeah.
You don't get the vapors.
So let's see a little bit more of this. Ravina says to Mareimar, Amar le Ravina le Mareimar, Veha Amar Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman says, Hai him milta de'atem ibei hin due sharia, umivarchin ale bodei pidei adama. He says, but didn't Rav Nachman say that it's permitted to eat this cooked ginger called himalta? That comes from India, where there's no concern, by the way, according to Rashi, that Gentiles cooked it. And we recite this blessing. Borei pri adama. It's a fruit of the ground. Apparently that ginger is edible. And he says, Lo kashya, ha beritivta, v'ha beveshta. The statement referring to wet ginger, which is considered food, and that earlier statement that Rava made, in other words, that you're exempt if you chew on the ginger, that's dry. Tanu Rabbanan. So, sages in the Braita, Achal Ale Kanim. If one ate the leaves of reeds on Yom Kippur, patur. So again, that was my example with the stick here.
Yeah.
Right? That now you're chewing on reeds.
If it's dry, you still say Borei pri adama?
No, so according to that little passage, the dry stuff I'm not going to say Borei pri adama, but the wet stuff I am. Achal ale kanim patur. If you eat reeds, you're exempt. Lulave gfanim, but if you eat grapevine shoots, you're liable. Sorry, no grapevine shoots.
It's again... I guess a matter of moisture in it, or something, right?
Yafe. So it could be that we're defining like what's going to be considered a little bit
juicy,
like juicy, yeah. Right? So anything juicy, forget it.
And
so far.
Edible, more satisfying.
Yeah.
These other things are very unpleasant.
Elohen lulevei gefanim. What are these, you know, kind of sprouts or shoots of grapevines you're talking about? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak migdala Rabbi Yitzchak from Migdal says the call. Kol shel lilevu merosh hashanah va'ad yom kippurim. He says if you take anything that sprouted from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, and you bring that in, these are very quote unquote young, right? And they're moist. And so, did you ever eat like pea shoots? Something like this?
Yeah.
Like the beginnings of pea plants have two nice little leaves on their stems. Mm-hmm. So early grape vines kind of look like very, very moist green little stems, from what I understand, over here. They're like shoots. They're sprouts. So no eating sprouts. But Rav Kahana Amar, Kol Shloshim Yom. And Rav Kahana says, no, even 30 days before Yom Kippur. Tanya Kavateh Rabbi Yitzchak Migdala, Rabbi Yitzchak from the Migdal says, Achal Alei Kani. It's taught that about eating those reeds that you're patur, v'lulavei gefanim chayav, and the little sprouts of grapevines, you're obligated, elu hen lulavei gefanim. Here's what lulavei gefanim really are, kol shelilu vomei rosh hashanah v'ad yom kippurim. We say just that little period of time. So if they're just from that little period of time, I'm chayav, but if they're not from that period of time, I'm left with patur. Shatat tzir or morayasa patur. Now let's get to the drink fish brine or this briny liquid or the fatty congealment of the fish stuff.
What is that aspic? Is that like gefilte fish?
Maybe.
That's good.
Yeah. So says some Ashkenazim. acquired taste, according to my children. Pacha, no doubt about it. These are all things that if we can convince just one-tenth of the next generation to like, I think we'll still be in good shape.
Maybe it was used as some kind of nutritious, almost medicine.
Of course,
right? So
of course, both.
Again, it's not under the category of a food, per se.
Both,
yeah.
Both.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
First of all, people would have like maybe a little taste of it to get rid of another taste that was terrible. Maybe it was medicinal. Maybe it was kind of like, you know, it's good for you. Drink that castor oil.
Yeah.
Ha chometz chayav. But if he drank vinegar, he's chayav. Right? You can do this fish brine, but not vinegar. Matnitin mani Rabbi Chiya. Who's the Tana of that Mishnah that taught that? That's got to be Rabbi. That's Rabbi. The Tanya who taught Rabbi Omer Chometz Meshiv Et HaNefesh. He says that vinegar enlivens the soul, meaning revives the body, revives the spirit. So I don't know. Anybody ever try to have just a little taste of like a balsamic vinegar? Just by itself, or just, you know, balsamic vinegar is good. Apple cider vinegar is actually good. You know, we're not talking about like really. Sometimes vinegar is too strong, but who knows? So last piece before the next Mishnah, we'll do the next Mishnah the next time. This is really good for us, right? We got through a Mishnah and it's Darash Rav Gidl Bar Menashe. Mi Birei Denerash. So Rav Gidl Bar Menashe from the town of Birei Denerash teaches the following. Ein halacha karebi. No, sorry. The halacha is not in accordance with Rebbe, who's Rebbe Yehuda. L'shana nafki kule alma. The next year everyone went out. Mazgu v'shatu chala. They went out and mixed, in other words, vinegar and water, and they drank. Shamar Rav Gidl v'ikpad. Rav Gidl heard this and became very angry. V'amar. Amar the Amiri Anna de Avad. He says, I said that one is not liable for drinking vinegar only after the fact, de Avad. However, Lechatchila mi Amiri, who says that from the get go, if you go do it, that you're going to be chayav? Amar the Amiri Anna Purta. He says, say that I said my statement with regard who drinks a little, Purta. Tuva mi amri. How about the one who says really you drink enough of an amount to really make it an amount? Amar de amri anachai. Mazug mi amri. He says, say that I said my statement in reference to pure vinegar, which is very strong. But did I say anything about diluted vinegar? That's certainly prohibited. So in other words, the argument is, can you really drink vinegar? Can you not drink vinegar? Can you drink diluted vinegar? Can you not drink diluted vinegar? The end of the story, that they're finding the right kind of, if you will, dvar lishtot, some kind of mashke, some kind of something you can wet your mouth with in order to be exempt from bringing any kind of guilt offering or, of course, being excommunicated. And in that vein, there's the humanity. There's the great humanity of the halachic system and the Yom Kippur and the expression of I'm connected to the rituals of Yom Kippur. Already asked the question and answered, was I ever at a place where anybody's passing around little shot glasses of fish brine? The answer is no.